I'm going to start. While there are few people here, I was saying earlier that my ratio is better because the panel I was at this morning, there were 5 people on the panel and only 40 people in the audience. So that's a ratio of 1 to 8. I'm at least a ratio of 1 to 20 here, so I'm doing okay. My name is Boyd Neal, and I'll introduce myself as we go on in the presentation to explain why it is that I'm here and what I'm talking about. But I have a question. How many people know what this reference is to in the tagline, or why you need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows? Bob Dylan. However, it's true that it's Bob Dylan's Subterranean Homesick Blues, but there was an organization in the U.S. in the late 60s that grew out of SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, called Weatherman. And Weatherman's name came from the Bob Dylan song. And the reason that they chose Weatherman is because Bob Dylan song says you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. In other words, that social change was going to happen in the U.S., and this organization, Weatherman, was going to assist in it. Weatherman was a radical, violent group that blew things up and shot cops. But they were part of that original radicalism in the late 60s. Now, why am I telling you this? But before I tell you that, I'm going to say there's one thing I'm not going to talk about today at all, and that is CONI 2012. How many people here are bored with CONI 2012 and the discussion online? I certainly am, but if you want to read a really good analysis of what's going on with these invisible children in CONI 2012, ethanzuckerman.com has a great analysis of both the strengths and weaknesses of the campaign, primarily the weaknesses of the campaign and the dangers in it. And that's the last I'm going to talk about CONI 2012, unless you ask questions, in which case I'll still not talk about it. So why am I here? A couple of years ago, cynics like Evgeny Morozov and Malcolm Gladwell questioned the value of the social web and its role in democracy. And I thought, oh, well, that'll disappear, especially after the Arab Spring. But we continue to get articles to question whether or not the social web can play any role in bringing about change. I took a look at this and I thought, now, wait a minute. I have worked with dozens of nonprofits who've used with more or less success social tools to bring about changes in people's thinking, to bring about fundraising, effective fundraising. Why then do we have public intellectuals and columnists and editorial writers still saying that the social web doesn't have a significant role in broader social change? I'll assume that they aren't doing this because they're stupid or that they think that it'll help their readership if they continue to write in this way by being contrarian. It's likely because they have no experience in organizing political action. Which brings me to what my experience is. Democracy requires that people who get angry do something about it. I have a particular experience when it comes to that. This was me when I was 22, and I had organized a demonstration. Most people in the U.S. won't remember this. Canadians might, except the people that I know that are here, are too young to remember it. But in 1970, the Canadian government brought in something called the War Measures Act. And the War Measures Act was as a response to the Fonds de Libération du Québec, which was FLQ, who had kidnapped some people. And the War Measures Act brought in extraordinary powers for the government, so they went and arrested 400 people in Quebec who were left-wing activists, intellectuals, filmmakers, without warrants and without any requirement to bring them to court for a specific period of time. It was an act of fascism, not dissimilar to things that happen sometimes in the U.S., but I, on the anniversary of that, I helped organize a demonstration that was to help us not forget that the Canadian government had acted in this, you know, what I felt at the time was a fascist way. I was arrested. I was beaten up by the cops. I ended up being accused of conspiracy to commit public mischief, and I spent 30 days in jail as a result of that. Pleading guilty to that, I pled guilty because a number of the people that were in our collective, our cell, were people from other countries, and they could have been deported. And they said, if I pled guilty, then these people would be let off. So I pled guilty, and I spent a month in jail. I went on from there, from being a left-wing activist. By the way, the reference to Weathermen is that the group that I worked with modeled itself on Weathermen, Weathermen without guns. We like to think of ourselves, because I'm Canadian, and you can't get guns quite so easily in Canada. It wasn't quite by choice that we didn't have the guns at the time. We certainly wanted them, but we were afraid. We thought, well, maybe if we talked to the Black Panther Party, they would help us find some guns, But anyway, we didn't. The group was called Red Morning that I worked with, which was the best thing that we could come up with, and there's no Bob Dylan song that has Red Morning in it, so it wasn't quite as poetic as Weathermen. So I went on after that to be a truck driver for 4.5 years, a trade unionist with the Canadian Food and Allied Workers, which is now the United Food and Commercial Workers here. I worked for the Brotherhood of Railroad, Airline, and Steamship Clerks. I was a negotiator, a plant chairman, which is the same thing as chief steward in a plant. So I did that for a number of years. I was a delegate to the Canadian Labour Congress, and I was essentially an agitator within unions, because I felt unions were not unlike bosses, as well as within the plant. None of which is to say that I am special, and it's not meant to be self-aggrandizing. It's simply to make the point that as an activist, a former activist, an organizer, I've been on the streets, but under a different paradigm. Now, no matter how much I may miss my youth, I thank Hugh MacLeod all the time. He does fabulous cartoons, Gaping Void. But no matter how much I miss my youth, I wouldn't change, I wouldn't give up what I have now as if I was an activist for what I had then. As much as I enjoyed fighting in the streets, not being beaten up particularly, but I enjoyed the feeling and the passion that was there, I'd rather be doing it today. I'm just a little old to be doing it. Now I write a little bit. That's my means of being an activist. But I'd rather do it today, because the tools that activists have in order to mobilize people, in order to challenge things within society that we think are wrong, the tools are immense. The tools are wonderful for organizers. So my argument is that slacktivism is not a problem, and that's what I'm going to focus on, and I'm going to end with 10 organizing principles that come out of my experience as an agitator and a trade unionist and a left-wing activist that I think still apply to organizing advocacy on the social web. Now, there are people in the room that are likely better than me able to talk about it. My colleague Andrew Bleeker there, who was instrumental in working on the Obama campaign and responsible for the transition, the digital aspects of transition in the Obama government, probably knows much more than I do about all of this, except I have some street experience, which I don't think you have, right? Debate experience, maybe street experience, no. So what I want to argue is slacktivism is not a problem in and of itself. The problem with, and I should say there are a number of studies that show that so-called slacktivism or in people who express their dissatisfaction online in a limited way, which is what slacktivism is, there is enough evidence now that from studies that say that the internet and social web activism, even if it's minimal, even if it's just clicking a like button on a Facebook, does lead to offline forms of public participation. So let's challenge the myth that because it's easy to express your dissatisfaction online, it means that you are not going to move to some form of offline action. Feel-good ties, maybe weak ties, but they're ties that can be moved in the right hands in the direction of political action. A single tweet might be easy to retweet, but the fact that the person has retweeted is a way of standing up. A person is standing up in a room full of everyone to say, I support this, I believe this. And in the hands of the right organizer, that kind of thing can become something bigger, something more effective, something more action-oriented. And even then, even if somebody just retweets something because they're unhappy with it, that doesn't mean they can't move in the direction of becoming more active. This is the description that one activist had of how they started to get involved with Greenpeace and what happened. And what they did was, first of all, they read a blog entry. And then they commented on the blog entry. Then they joined a forum to discuss issues. I can't remember what the issues were, environmental issues, I assume. Then they became a local volunteer, offering to spend a couple of hours doing some canvassing, something like that. Then they collected signatures on the street, and they collected money on the street. And then after that, they felt like, geez, I'm making a difference. So they took an internship at Greenpeace, a non-paid internship with a local office of Greenpeace. And then finally, they joined up with that advocacy group and got a full-time job. So that's the trajectory, starting from a simple reading of a blog or a blog comment about how people can move through that. So slacktivism, as far as I'm concerned, is quite simply a fault of organizers not doing their job properly. Moving people to social action is nonlinear, it's messy, it's fraught with challenges, but it can begin anywhere. And it's the job of an organizer to give it the order and structure that leads to change, that leads to action. So I don't think we should panic. As organizers, I don't know if there are many organizers in the room, but I don't think we should panic that people will only click a button or sign a petition. As a friend of mine, Rob Cottingham, said in the Globe and Mail this morning, again about that video that seems to be everyone paying attention to, the 29-minute video, I said I wouldn't mention the name anymore. He said, for a lot of people, sharing something will be their first case of activism. They're filled with the kind of enthusiasm you're seeing from people who are becoming engaged politically for the first time. It's the job of the organizer to turn that sharing, for example, when people retweet into something that is change, that will change things, something that is going to have an impact in the long run. So I'm going to talk a little about organizers. This is a quote from, we used to, there were books that we read in the 70s like Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals or Régis Debray's We Are All the Tupamaros and Che Guevara's writings as well. But this always stuck in my mind from what Saul Alinsky said. And I like it because it's a statement of what really motivates people who organize, and that is, to the organizer, imagination is the dynamism that starts things. So as an organizer, you have to be imaginative about what you want to accomplish. But the end of it, I think, is also true. You have to laugh. You have to be able to laugh as an organizer because that's what gives you energy. I'm going to talk a little bit now about, and I'll get to some organizing principles. And by the way, please interrupt if you have questions. And I can tell you what it was like in jail, and it's not as bad as everybody thinks it is. I was at a panel yesterday, day before yesterday, in which there was a guy. Yeah.
So are you going to post the presentation just
because
I can't see the words back here?
Yeah, I know. I can happily post it anywhere. Yeah. In fact, if we put the Hill and Knowlton strategies on the front, I'm sure that the people I work for will be happy if I post it somewhere. So, except when they see the content, of course, because what I'm doing is telling you how to organize against my clients. So I hope that part won't go out of the room. Where was I? Oh, yeah. I was at a panel day before yesterday in which there was a guy named Jason Young who was talking about prisons and the importance of challenging the fact that prisoners are not allowed to have social tools. They're not allowed to have access to computers and to social networks, and how this silence and separation is how prisons in the U.S. are structured. And I got up to challenge him a little bit, and I said, frankly, that's a bit of bullshit because that isn't what prisons are like. In fact, part of the problem in jails in particular is that you're close to too many people that you don't want to be close to and that you don't really want to talk to. So anyway, I can answer more questions about jail at some point if you like. So what I want to talk about now is a couple of simple things. First of all, a way to think of organizing on the social web. Organizing on the social web is about a continuum of ways in which people connect with you or interact with you online. And there are four ways, I think, that people will do that. There's connection, there's engagement, there's influence and action. And they move, and it's a continuum. The job of the organizer is to accept the fact that some people will only connect, but to see if they can find a way to move towards engagement. And if they're engaged, then it's the responsibility of the organizer to say, how can I get them to influence their network? And then if they begin, if the people that are involved in the campaign you're involved with are already beginning to influence the people with whom they're with, then you can move them to action. But each step of the way, is the responsibility of the organizer to move people along that continuum, to find ways to move them along. So if all I want to do is connect, if all I want to do is click like, it's not my fault if you as an organizer don't come to me and say, well, you've clicked like, how would you like to do this? That's the job of the organizer. And at each step of the way here on that continuum, there's things that you can do on the social web that help people involve themselves with your campaign. At the connection level, you can educate people. You can increase the amount of information you provide to them. If they're already engaged, then you can work out ways to help people organize themselves to act. If they're at the influence level, you can work on creating the courage to act. And I think this is one of the most significant things in the Arab Spring. The issue of whether or not the Arab Spring or the changes that have happened in Egypt and Tunisia would have happened with or without Facebook, and how important it was as part of the revolutions that went on, will be debated for a long time. But the one thing that's undeniable is that by seeing friends of yours going out on the street, created the courage to act for you to go out on the street, and that is one of the toughest jobs of an organizer, is creating among the people who are involved in a campaign, giving them the courage to stand up and to say, I support this, I'm going to do something about it. And then you move them to action, and those actions can be simple actions like sending an email, or they can be street actions. They can be violence if that's what's necessary to whatever the campaign is. So that's the theoretical background to what I want to say, and I'm going to go on to, now these, I have 10 organizing principles, and these organizing principles are a combination of what I learned as an activist in the early 70s for about 5 years, what we did then, and their application to how you go about doing exactly the same thing on the social web. In the 60s and 70s, when we organized things, how things got rolling were that, first of all, people would gather. They would meet. They would meet at a demonstration, they'd have a party, we'd meet in the park, we'd meet at a concert, we'd smoke dope together or drop acid together, and then we would share ideas, right? We would exchange ideas, and perhaps out of that would come action. Today what happens is people share. They share on Facebook, they share IM, they share on Flickr, on blogs, they share their ideas, and then they gather. They gather and coalesce around particular ideas, whether it's a complaint, whether it's an action, whether it's a party idea. So that's the difference between organizing then and today. Today you can actually gather, you can actually share first, and then proceed to the coalescing of the ideas. So what I'm going to do is go through each one of these and give a couple of examples of how it works in the real world, perhaps, and I hope you'll find it valuable. I think the first principle is to contain anger and to find ideological balance. One of the biggest failings of most activist groups is that they assume that what they're angry about, other people will be angry about. Or they assume that if they present their ideological perspective, that somehow that will help win people over. A good example of this is, it's a very important campaign, which is by this organization, which is Rape is No Joke. That's a significant subject. But the problem is that if you read down at the bottom, and I apologize, it's a little hard to see, but at the bottom what they've started to post about is about 20,000 cops being on the streets during some political activity that happened a year ago around the G20 in Toronto. And there's a disconnect there between them being angry about cops on the street and the focus of their campaign, which is about rape is no joke. That disconnect is driven by ideology. They're a left-wing organization. It's not driven by what the message is that they're trying to communicate or what actions they're trying to organize. And that disconnect is the kind of thing that prevents people, perhaps like me, who support the main cause, for becoming more active in the campaign. So the first thing is set aside your anger, because your job is to organize, not to shout, not to complain, not to use your platform, in this case rape, in order to go attack every ill in society. The extent to which you do that is the extent to which you lose people's interest. You'll find that they're unable to agree with you and will move on to another cause. So don't move away from your core organizing message. Keep with your core organizing message, and don't substitute anger for argument. We're intelligent. We need to know why it is that there is this focus on rape is no joke, what it is that we should do about it. Shouting only goes so far. So that's the first principle. Don't let your anger or your ideology substitute for recognizing that you have to set it aside in order to be able to win people over to your cause. The second thing is make action choices straightforward, obvious, and easy. One of the things that happened a few years ago, there was a big campaign, and my colleagues from Canada might remember when there was a political campaign against the proroguing of Parliament that came about in order to shut down some discourse. And there was a huge backlash against that. And the backlash focused on Facebook. There were 250,000 people that had liked a Facebook page that opposed the proroguing of Parliament. But nothing happened, because the Facebook page was simply a place that people could click the like box. The organizers missed the opportunity to say, okay, you've expressed dissatisfaction with what the Stephen Harper government in Canada is doing. Now, here's some easy ways that you can act. How about if you volunteer to organize a demonstration in your city? How about if you volunteer to be part of a phone tree that gets people out? How about if you volunteer your technological knowledge in order to create an app that might help organize people? So the Facebook page did nothing to help me, as somebody who disagreed with that, move to the next step. And not only did they do nothing, if they'd done something, one suspects it would have been more complicated than is necessary. There's a really good group in Canada, I don't know if they're in the U.S. as well, called Apathy is Boring, and they do a great job of getting people, offering on their website ways for you to move beyond just saying, yeah, you know, I support the need for political activity. They help you move to the next step. You know, they offer calls to actions. They offer petitions. Petitions can be powerful. I mean, mostly they're a waste of time, as we know, but they educate you on their main page about what it means to engage. They urge you to imagine something different. They offer places that you can go to express your willingness to become engaged right there on their homepage. So you can learn all you need to know about how to help them on their homepage. So make the choices easy for people so that they can know what it means to engage more. That's your job as an organizer. You should connect everywhere. I mean, how many websites do you go to for organizations that are trying to organize people to perform some kind of social action? And, you know, they'll have a Facebook page and a Twitter page, a Twitter account perhaps, and that's about it. They don't take advantage of the fact that the social web allows you to connect everywhere. So use all of the social tools. Because I Am a Girl is a campaign that is run by Plan Canada. It's a global campaign. And one of the things that they do is they display and they repeat places that you can go to connect with them. It's a wonderful campaign. They use visual platforms. They use multiple points of access for connection. So you're taking people there are people who like to connect on YouTube, or they like to see photographs, so they connect on Flickr. So use all of those tools instead of assuming that a web page in which you simply espouse your point of view, your anger, your dissatisfaction is enough to move people. You have to help them move by helping them connect with you anywhere where they are. So that's number three. Number four is use social tools to organize. This is the part that I think for an ex-organizer is most significant, is one of the difficulties that we had in the early 70s with campaigns was figuring out how to build cells, how to keep people connected when they were in a cell. I assume everybody knows that that's how left-wing organizations and Al-Qaeda as well are organized, is in cells. But the difficulty is, how do you keep people together? How do you keep them motivated? How do you keep them organized in those cells? Today, we can do it using social tools. It's one of the things that I find actually interesting about Google Plus. I mean, I think it's a marvelous platform for social organizing because of the ability to create circles, because of the ability to have hangouts. You work as an activist often in very small groups. Those groups would be perfect within Google Plus. Of course, there's issues of, you know, of whether or not you can be watched while you're doing that, but that doesn't matter. Smart organizers know how to get around that. In the old activist model, this was the toughest thing to do. There were only a couple of alternatives. You could have meetings. They could be clandestine. They could be public. You could have phone trees. You could have parties where the party was really an excuse to get together to mobilize an activity. But now we have a whole suite of tools. And there are some online platforms that will help you do this. There's crabgrass.org, for example. There's a whole bunch of them that will help you organize your team of activists to get ready for some kind of action. So use all those social tools to organize. Mobile Commons, for example, which Andrew said was used during the Obama campaign, it's based primarily on phone connections, but I mentioned Google Plus is an excellent, I think, way for organizers to bring their teams together. The fifth thing is that give people offline connection and action opportunities. And I'm quite proud of this example. Not that I had anything to do with it, but it was it's a fabulous offline organizing tool. It was two Canadians who were opposed to SOPA and created a mobile app where you could use the app to scan barcodes in stores to see whether or not the company that had produced the product was for or against SOPA. So it was a simple app. It was free. It was developed by two Canadians. I don't know why. They were just, concerned that this would spill over, SOPA would spill over and affect Canadians. But to me, it was a perfect example of using online connection with people to create offline action. I don't know how many people downloaded the app, but I can't think of a better example of creating a way to actually act offline, to learn things about, and to determine who your targets are, for example, for a boycott, that kind of thing. The sixth thing is identify local network leaders and empower them. And to me, this is, in old activism, we created cells with leaders and we coordinated locally and internationally. We at Red Morning were set up. We had networks to connect us with a group in Chicago called Rising Up Angry. We also had connections to the White Panther Party, which was based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And those were personal connections. They were connections by phone. We traveled, we hitchhiked to go and meet these people. New activism now, there's the possibility to identify local network leaders globally or locally, and to have those people become new activists for you. There are organizations, there are platforms that will help you do this. So Get Up, for example, is an independent grassroots community advocacy organization which giving Australians an opportunity to get involved and to identify themselves as an individual who wants to take a lead in their particular area. Or Move On is another one, or Jumo is another one that, Leavers Connection Technologies, to help people say, I'm willing to take action, and I'd like to lead a group of people to take action. So identify local network leaders using the tools that are available. Just a couple of examples here. I don't know if anyone knows about the February 29th shut down the corporations movement, which was it came out of the Occupy movement. I think it's been ineffective. And if you look at their Facebook page, you can see why. The point is, there's nowhere for you if you are interested in acting or were interested in acting on February 29th to stand up and say, I'd like to organize this demonstration in Toronto, or I'd like to organize this demonstration in Nashville or wherever. So the focus for the organizing of this action was Facebook. But there was nowhere there that anyone who wanted to participate could actually identify other than to say, I'd like to support this organization. Whereas People and Planet, on the other hand, they offer opportunities for you to self-identify as somebody willing to take on a cause, and then they help you walk you through how to go about building a cell in your area. That's the strength of the social web. The Facebook page, by the way, of F29 has only about 2,000 likes. So if you're trying to organize a mass movement and you only have 2,000 likes, you're not going to get very far, I don't think. The seventh one, only three more to go, is personalize the relationship. One of the strengths of the social web is being able to build personal connection and personal relationship. A good example of this is, you know, under old activism, what we would do is we'd work with individuals to determine their willingness to engage and their level of comfort. You know, so for example, there were people who didn't want to go out on the street and demonstrate because they were afraid of being beaten up. And then there were people who were quite happy to have a street fight, and we would accept the fact that the people who didn't want to go and fight didn't have to. There was a band, for example, which was called Sound Horn. It was named after a garage. You know how we go into a garage and sometimes they say Sound Horn in order to tell that your car's coming down the ramp. So they created this band called Sound Horn, which is actually quite good band. They didn't want to be active on the streets. They wanted to create music as their way of being part of the revolution. That was old activism. Today, it's easy to find ways to get individuals to connect with their friends, to personalize your anger. So this campaign by Amnesty International was a simple campaign to free a political prisoner. What it said was is that if you support this, take a picture of yourself next to the placard, and then here's how you email that placard that picture of yourself to the president of Azerbaijan, it was. So what it did was it allowed you to personalize. It allowed you to stand up and say, I support this cause. Not only that, I'm willing to put my face to the cause. That's a positive reinforcement to somebody to say, who wants to say, I can make a difference. Even if they know that the email's not going to be read, they've stood up, they've said, here I am, and I am opposed to whatever the activity is. The eighth thing, and I've got two more to go, is facilitate peer-to-peer opportunities. One of the things that was always difficult to do in old activism was to expand beyond the core cell of people, because it was very difficult to find ways to get people that were members of the cell because they lived their life in the cell. So it was difficult to get them to move to reaching out to any other peers to bring them into the network. That is not a problem anymore. For example, Restore, it's a place that where you, you know, I mean, there's a number of reasons why it's an excellent site. It begins from your own story. But the main thing is it makes starting your own peer-to-peer campaign easy. So you're amplifying the goal of this, which is to try and raise funds for people who've been part of the sexual traffic trade. But it allows you, without having to go to a meeting, without having to meet anyone from Restore, to build your own campaign using your peers. So it amplifies the reach of the campaign. Ninth is provide incentives for offline action. It's something that you don't think of, generally speaking, when you're organizing a campaign. But why not find ways to incentivize people to act? In old activism, we used to have simple, clear messages. We'd offer action alternatives. We'd give people the opportunity to distribute leaflets or to sell newspapers on the street corner for 25 cents, you know, to organize. I used to love the spray painting slogans in particular. That was fun because you do it in the middle of the night and, you know, it was exciting and romantic. But you have to provide incentives for that action. And the way that some organizations are doing it today, like this organization, which is I Paid a Bribe, which is opposing bribery around the world, one of the things that they do is they do a game-style ranking of people based on the success of their personal effort to oppose bribery. And those personal efforts are quite, you know, where somebody in India, which is one of the examples here, refused to pay a bribe to a civil servant who wanted to have a certain amount of money in order to speed the process of getting a passport or something like that. And what they did was they had a contest to see who could submit the best example of opposing bribery, and the person who won the person who got the most votes for the successful action, you know, got to be featured on the front page of the website. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with using game style ranking, for example, as a way to reward people for their action, or give them personal invitations to events. Nothing wrong with that, or special education and training opportunities. There are boot camps for activists that happen all over the U.S. A lot of people can't go to them, but why not reward action by offering people the opportunity to go to a boot camp in Scottsdale or somewhere to learn how to be a better activist? And then finally, and this is my third to last slide, create content that rocks. One of the things that is most difficult, you know, I primarily counsel corporations, and one of the things that's most difficult about doing that is that how boring most of the work is that they want you to do. One of the benefits, I think, of working for a Greenpeace, for example, is you get to create fabulous animations like that one, the Unfriend Coal one, if you've ever seen that. It's a fabulous animation. And I'm thinking, you know, if I wasn't so concerned about certain ideological elements of Greenpeace, I'd love to work for them just to be able to create really exciting content. But that's what you need to do as an organizer, is find ways to create exciting content. You can get help doing this, by the way. The Tactical Technology Collective is an organization that will provide you with the tools to create exciting content. They'll teach you how to make infographics, for example, that can bring about social change. They'll give you a message in a box programs or mobiles in a box. How do you build a mobile campaign, for example? So there are tools, free tools available to you as an organizer to create content that rocks. I put this slide up because I heard yesterday or a day before somebody said, you know, I just really like this image. It's got absolutely nothing to do with my presentation. But isn't that a fabulous image? It could convert me to Buddhism. That could. But anyway, I'm perfectly willing to answer any questions, especially about life in jail, if that is what you'd like to hear. Any questions? Nope. Ah. I think that they should start by looking at successful nonprofits who do this well. You know, the ones that I know are the Canadian ones, like Plan Canada, because I am a girl. You don't necessarily have to agree with their campaign, but to look at how they structure their activities, how they build their website in order to drive people towards engagement, how they create a site that is, you know, visually exciting, that means that you want to connect, but then they don't let you just sit there. They move you along. So that's how I would do it. A website is, generally speaking, where the focus needs to be put, because it's going to be the hub for the way in which you build your program, your campaign. But I'd pick any one of those organizations that, you know, the ones that I've shown here. There's dozens of them. Interestingly, I think that nonprofits as opposed to campaign sites. Nonprofits do it well. And the techniques that they use are techniques that activists can use to organize political or social opposition, for example, and should. Yes? Sorry, I didn't hear the last part of what you said. Could you just...
Was SOPA, was it actually as large of a protest as it seemed like, or was it just that, you know, it's a very vocal audience that was so publicly affected by this issue?
Probably a combination of both. I mean, it was... It's interesting because there was a parallel thing going on in Canada at the same time. So certainly for people who were there, it was changes in our legislation, PIPEDA, which is our Privacy Information Protection something Act. And it was happening. And I think the sense was, and certainly the feeling that I had, was is that that because the things happened at the same time, there was a sense of threat that was North American-wide. So, and I think that sense of threat meant that the dialogue and discussion and concern expressed was amplified significantly. I don't know of, well, there were organizations in Toronto, in Canada, openmedia.ca, for example, led this battle. I don't think they did a particularly good job of it. You know, I should send them my organizing principles because they don't make it easy if you want to support what they're doing to contribute to their activity, which they should. I think it was less the quality of organizing and more just that sense of fear that this was happening in a number of places that really mobilized or amplified the what was going on. Yeah. So the first part of your question was, how do I apply these principles to what I do as my day job? Cautiously. But I think that, you know, I work for organizations a good example. I work for an organization that has a mining company, a Canadian mining company, that had a mine in Guatemala in which there was a significant protest around it. And one of the things that I was able to help the client understand is the strengths and weaknesses of how the people who were organizing against what they were doing, how they could understand the way in which the campaign was likely to unfold. But I was also able, for example, to caution them about not taking, not overreacting to what was happening, because I could see that the organized opposition, and here I'm not going to get into the moral question of whether it was right or wrong, but I could see that the activity of the organizers in opposition to what the client was doing, those activities were unfocused. They were poorly organized. They weren't going to go anywhere. The second thing is that they make the mistake, the opponents, and it's a group called Rights Action. They make the mistake that I said right at the beginning of just being angry and of not telling the truth. And if, it's the worst mistake, I think, although and all activist groups do it, is to exaggerate, to lie, to distort facts about what's going on. Far better as an activist group for you to actually tell the truth about what a company's doing, to appear balanced, to appear non-ideological, because you don't need to worry about the anger. That will be there. What you need to worry about is winning people over who are on the fence. So that was a bit off what you said. But anyway, I think it's useful, given my experience and my understanding of organizing, it's useful for me to be able to provide corporations with some understanding of how the opposition to them is going to act. And that's, from an ideological perspective, part of the reason I'm not an organizer is because I've seen too many lies on the other side. You know, a great example, the reason I'm not a trade unionist anymore is I went to the Canadian Labour Congress in the mid-1970s, and I was the delegate from my local. And it was in Vancouver, and I'm from Toronto, and I flew out there, and I stayed at the Four Seasons Hotel. This is a factory we're talking about, right? It was an ice cream chocolate bar, Nielsen's chocolate bar factory that I was the plant chairman of. And I flew out there, stayed at the Four Seasons, lived on an expense account, and had money left over. And I went and I bought a shirt and a pair of pants. And I went back to the local, and I said, okay, I've got $150 left. I want to give it back. And they said, no. I said, why not? They said, because it'll spoil it for the rest of us if you give it back. And I mean, it's a simple incident and it had built up, but it was that sense of, the right and wrong is far more complex. I'd been a trade unionist for 4 years at that point, and I believed passionately in trade unionism. And I'm still, the only, the organization I work for, Hill & Knowlton, has something we have a code of conduct, and one of the, I think it's clause 5 in our code of conduct, says if we don't agree ethically with something that we're doing, we can refuse to work on the work. And the only work that I won't do work on, not the only work, but one of the things I won't do work on, for example, is when scabs are used in strikes, because I truly believe that's, that scabs should not be allowed on. They cause violence, and they shouldn't be allowed when there's a strike on. I'm still passionate, but I've seen too many lies from all sides to say I could be ideologically committed, to trade unionism now. I give long-winded answers, don't I? Sorry. Hope that was helpful. Any other questions? Yes. Right. Okay, Jason Rockwood. Thank you. Yeah, that's right.
Using the social media tools is a critical thing nowadays, especially for organizations that don't have gigantic budgets. One of them you mentioned was Google Plus, and you mentioned it about the data. So that is, you're saying how that.
Yeah, even when we didn't have the social web, you were always cautious. We found out afterwards, many years afterwards, about who the informants were in the cells that we worked with. A number of years later, it came out who they were. I was interviewed by the RCMP when I'm a British citizen as well as Canadian citizen, and I was interviewed when I was getting my passport, which was, I was 27, I guess, 28 at the time. And so I had to go and be interviewed because I had a criminal record and I'd obviously been identified as a political activist. And in the course of the RCMP interview, I got citizenship, by the way. The RCMP officers, revealed who it was that was in the group. And it was quite shocking, actually, to find out that this person you'd worked with for 4 years had been an informant all along. And I guess the same thing's true now of Anonymous, the hacker group that's been, some of the people have been arrested as a result of an informant. So, as an activist, you always have to be careful. So that's the first thing. And you can assume if you're an activist, even somebody like Oxfam, that if you're building circles, that somebody in those circles is going to be an informant. You know, if that's a concern, given, you know, whatever campaign you're working on, and you have to act accordingly and be cautious. So that's the first thing. In terms of the use of the analytics, I mean, I'm a believer in transparency. I believe that the more transparent people are, the better chance it is that you win over people who are on the fence about whether to support you. So I'm not, you know, I think when it comes to analytics, for example, revealing the weakness of the support for your program, for example, which a government agency might want to do if they wanted to undermine you, I don't think that's a bad thing, because if I'm passionate about the idea and I haven't actually participated with you, and I suddenly see that, you know, by your analytics you're not getting the support for the campaign that you need, then it might just be the thing that tips me over the scale to acting on your behalf, for example. So that's how I would approach it. Yes?
I was hoping you could speak more to the difference between, in previous generations, people meeting and then exchanging ideas after, versus now you have sharing coming first, especially when you think of organizing and sales and keeping relationships personal. Like, I can think of... you know, if you have somebody that you're personally and physically connected to in life, that there's also, you don't want to disappoint them, and you don't want, that you will be held more responsible because you have a relationship in person. That might be true of the internet as well, although I don't know what the checks and balances are for that. So maybe if you can talk about how to, if an organization is on the bridge where they want to go into creating cells, maybe some advice about how it's different today than it used to be.
The difference today is, the difference then is that we used to do a lot of drugs, and so you find out, you know, when you've dropped acid with somebody, you find out whether or not you can trust them, and so So I don't know what the equivalent is on the social web of doing acid. I don't know. When I look at it, look at the relationships I've built as a result of the social web over the last couple of years. I feel quite close to some people I've never met. And I feel when I meet them that I'm not starting from scratch. You know, I met connected to a guy from Ottawa. I don't know, some of my colleagues, ex-colleagues in the front row here might know him, Ryan Anderson. I'd never met him before. We've exchanged all kinds of information online. We had a party on Friday night here. Hill and Knowlton had a party. And his invitation was he wanted to come to the party, and he was rejected because I guess it was full. And he sent me a note, on Twitter to say, "Gee, I won't be able to see you tonight because, you know, my request to come to the party has been rejected." And I said, "Well, of course I will put you on the list, you know." And I got right away and I went and put him on the list. So I had sufficient trust in him, even though I'd never met him, to say, "I want you at this party." And so the quality of relationship that you can develop online, to me, is no different. It's not quite as much fun than it used to be, I have to say. But, I still think you are able to, with a broader number of people, with interactions and conversation and relationship online, you're able to find out whether or not they are somebody that you could work with around a political campaign. So does that answer your question?
Well, but also there's getting somebody over that hump of moving from the digital to the physical space. Mm-hmm. Are there ways, is it just a matter of organizing an event that they think is going to be cool and getting them there?
It depends on the type of person. Sometimes it's the opportunity for that person to be a leader within something. You know, you make an assessment of what it's like... It's like the assessment that we did of people, whether or not they would be part of a cell that was going to be what we called a fighting cell. You know, a cell that would go out in a demonstration and actually try and cause damage and create a fight versus somebody. And one of our one of the leaders in our organization that I'm still friends with today, that demonstration that I had up on the screen there, that was defined as a fighting action. We organized it. We said we are going to do damage in downtown Toronto, and so naturally there were going to be police there. She was a leader in the organization, and she was terrified. And instead of the morning of the demonstration, she took a train out of the city so that she didn't have to be faced with our being upset at this leader in our organization, frankly, not wanting to fight, even though we trained and everything like that. So, obviously what we should have done is assessed that she wasn't that kind of person and given her something else to do, offered her the opportunity. There were other people who came out came to us and said, I want to be one of the people who leads this demonstration because I'm so angry about this. And, so we gave them the opportunity to be, heading a small cell of or team of people that were, assigned to do specific damage in specific places. So you just, you have to assess what people's tolerance is for the activity. Some people want to be leaders, want to be identified as leaders. Some people want to only stuff envelopes. And each one of those activities is valuable to the organization. Just assess and don't guilt people that they should do more, but steadily over a period of time, you can move them to, from up that continuum from connection, engagement, to influence and action. So any other questions? That's good. Oh, one more. Yeah.
Hi, how's it going? I'm Jamie from Sydney, and we do a bit of work for Greenpeace and GetUp down there, and UNHCR and a bunch of other NGOs down there. And one thing that I've noticed in the work that we've been doing over the last 5 years is the communicating wins kind of aspect. One thing that we've had a problem with different clients we've worked with before and observed in them before we started working with them is that they were really bad at kind of getting up and saying, hey, we've got this far in this thing, or we've just won this amazing thing. We created a origami whales campaign against whaling in the Southern Oceans a couple of years ago, and right, we've got 180,000 people on a petition, but one thing that Greenpeace did quite poorly at that time was follow up on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something we consistently kind of notice. Like, what do you think? I mean, I was just looking at the principles, and it was something that we're always going to our clients and saying, like, whether it's getting another 100 people on the page or another 1,000 people on the page or whatever. Like, there's opportunities to communicate wins, and those are really strong for garnering more support or getting people on the fence over the fence. If they see a whole lot of other people going, there's this kind of flocking mentality that seems to go on. Do you think that's a principle? Or?
It should be principle 11. But 10, I agree with you, and I think it's something that's missing from my presentation. In fact, it should be there because I think, one of the frustrations with petitions, and there are all kinds of organizations that create platforms like Avaz and petitionsite.org and from Care2, that create platforms for petitions. But the problem is that so few petitions have wins attached to them that eventually people are going to get tired of signing petitions. So it's critical if your campaign involves a petition to demonstrate if you've had any wins, because that's one of the things that will move people from connection to engagement, is knowing that the activity that or engagement to influence, it's knowing that their activity has actually made a difference, no matter how small it is. And it should really be principle number 11, but, it's usually, we think in fives and tens in the social. How many articles begin with 5 steps to better, Twitter use, 4 steps to, or 3 steps? We never get 11 steps, really. So, but I will add it in because I agree with you. Critical. Any other questions? It's lunchtime. I'm hungry. Well, thank you very much. I hope it's been useful, and I will make the presentation available gladly. So thank you. Thank you.
Old school fellow travelers across the digital divide.
Thank you.
I loved it, and please let me know when you have your posting up. I want to check it out.
I will. If not, I'll send it to you. Right. I'll email it to you. Thanks. Yeah, I don't know where it'd be. I'm not sure, but I'll find out where it'll be, where it can be posted. So, if not, if you have a card, I can email it to you. I'm happy to email it to you. Or you could write down on a piece of paper. I don't have a pen. Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do. I think I do. I'll take that back. I don't.
You don't. All right. Well, thanks anyway.
Okay, I'll try and find a public site where I could. Well, I could post it to SlideShare. Yeah, I'll do that.
Just by the name of
Chris. Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Hi.
I'm from Toronto.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Who do you work with?
I work with a company called Authentic.
So oh, really?
It's a different... It's not a... But I've got one property that's a new property that we're launching that's a social activism property to do with... I'd love to pick your brain, like, back in the city. I'm sure you're right.
Sure.
I know you work with larger organizations. Our property is small, and the women behind it, it's to do with, like, we're part of a company called Hoover, an organization called Hoover, which it's a menstruation, it's all about menstruation in young girls, and education
right.
The organization Hoover provides these packs to applicants. So we're just starting. We have,
right.
We create, we have, you know, Twitter, we have this, our social media, and we have a website that we are redesigning, an interactive property that we're redesigning and redesigning. So these guys have come to our company and now we're in a partnership.
Yeah.
But it could be interesting because I know you work with a lot larger organizations,
yeah,
but it could be great for these women that I'm working with to have a meeting and to chat
yeah,
with you.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, I'm, you know, I'm 62, so I'm going to be retiring soon.
Right,
that
right.
means I can go back to what I was doing when I was 22.
Right,
you know,
right,
so
right.
I don't mind that as part of the transition. I'll say that to my colleagues here,
right,
but you know,
right.
So
yeah,
I'm happy to help.
But it would be really great because
yeah.
I mean, they're just sort of starting a new space.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk. You know, or you know, I can do a presentation
yes,
to them.
Yeah.
You know, this
yeah.
a sort of shortened one for them if you like.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd
in
be
the
happy
same
to.
City, so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. No, I'd be happy to.
Yeah. Okay,
okay
then,
great.
Thanks.
Hello.
Hi. How are
I'm
you?
I'm Louisa. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for your question.
No, it's okay. I just wanted to say I know how it is
yeah,
to make the transition. I've done it myself. That's
oh,
why
yeah.
I wanted.
Well, there are more people that have done that transition than you think.
It
you know?
Is. It is tough, but I. You know, congratulations.
Yeah.
For keeping the good
one. Yeah. I'm coming back to it.
That was great.
Thanks. Thanks.
Well, just so I give you my card, Jamie.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm
sorry
you should
about
have.
The extra principal.
What?
Sorry about pulling.
Oh, I know, but you're right, and I, you know, I should have thought of it, and I did it.
GitHub's really good at it.
Is it?
Yeah, and they have been for quite a long time. They're really great at going. If we get 2,000 signatures, we're going to skyrocket up the
yeah.
house.
Oh yeah.
Whatever.
Well, that's
so
the kind of thing,
have, they actually have events kind of based around wins, and so people see those things in the media. Which is so fantastic. I think there's just so many positions that get signed that just...
Yeah, they don't go anywhere and, you know.
Go. And that, over time, actually really, I think, weakens the whole idea of online activism
yeah.
in a way. Like,
yeah,
you know,
yep.
become less inclined to...
Well, I think you're right, and that's what I you know, some of the companies that I work for have been under attack by petitions for some of their activities, and I, you know, I sort of look at it, and the petition will say required 10,000 signatures, and I'm thinking, so where did they get that number from? What is, you know, why 10,000? What's that going, you know, is that going to make a difference to anything? You know, they just die out. You know, 4,500 people sign. They don't take it, you know, they don't take those 4,500 and move them anywhere else. They don't, you know, they don't take the 4,500 and celebrate the fact that 4,500 people have stood up in any way. So I think you're absolutely
I think
right.
Those, like both having the targets or having targets that have attainable kind of results
yeah.
as well. Like when we get 10,000, we're going to go.
Yeah, we're going to do this. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
that's
then
right.
and then doing it, and then taking photos and doing it, and then tweeting about it. And
yeah.
then, all of those people in turn pass a lot of
yeah.
things around, feel a little bit of warmth and
yeah.
you know, and then more loyal, I think, to the cause. So,
yeah. I'm going to add yours in as number 11 and give you full credit for it. So yeah. in my next presentation, your name will be up there.
Okay.
So thank you very
speech.
Much.
Really
thank you.
It.
Thank you for coming.
Great job.
It was okay.
It was good.
Yeah, I get passionate. I couldn't decide if there were it was better that there were fewer people or if there were more people, if it would have been better. But anyway.
I think it was good.
Yeah.
I think the turnout was pretty good, especially for the audience.
Hmm?
Especially for the Omni-Lens.
That's a bit, it's a bit crappy location. I didn't realize it this morning, until this morning, because I hadn't been here. And I came up and I thought, well, first of all, I can't find the fucking hotel. Where is it? The hotel, yeah.
I couldn't have somebody who's from out of town where it was. But, well, you went to meet my friend Kate.
Hi, Kate. How are you?
Nice to meet you.
You're not in H&K, are you?
No, I'm not. I went to college with Katie. That's how we met.
Where'd you go to college?
St. Edward's University.
I don't know. It's a
small liberal arts school.
Is it? Nice, nice. School. So what do you do?
I manage social media. Oh,
yeah? Ah, wow. Yeah, we pitched the Ontario Real Estate Board to do social media. We didn't win. We went to Edelman. So, anyway.
You win some, you lose some.
You do. I wish we won more and lost fewer, but, you know, that's that happens. So,
one question that
I could relax now, which is really nice. I feel like I've been stressed for 2 days, you know, about
it's good to get this over.
Yeah, now I'm going
to
really enjoy
it.
Yeah, and the sun is out, which is even better. So that's great. Yeah.
What do you do when you care about your cause, you have solid facts, but you keep getting criticism online? It's such an easy breeding ground for people to just be like, you're stupid.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a believer in that if you are sincere and speak with integrity, and you just keep at it, then all of those people who shout and yell at you will disappear. And I can't think of anything else to do other than that. And even within H&K, I find that, you know, if you think that something should happen, instead of shouting and yelling, you know, you just steadily talk about it, and eventually, the people who are opposed just disappear. And you know, I can't think of anything else to do. You know, it's like people say, well, why should I have comments open on YouTube? Because it's a wild west of, you know, of criticism. I mean, you get the most, you know, but just, you know, keep it open, respond with integrity, and let the community come to your defense at some point, which happens all the time.
Right.
Yeah, you know, that's, I don't know.
Speaks to the importance.
Yeah, I think that's why it's critical even for advocates to tell the truth and to not just express anger, because your community is built when people move from the emotional to the rational, right? When they say, you know, I'm really passionate about this cause, but if all you build off is that passion for the cause as opposed to building the infrastructure of facts behind it, then the community won't come to your defense, you know. And did that make sense, what I was saying? Like, I was saying that the that building the community can't just be a community that's around anger, because it won't come to your defense. You've got to move them to taking that anger to a complete